For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Tonight's class is dedicated by friends of Dr. Hurwitz, Shmuel Yosef Halevi ben Yaffa, and the merit of a refuah shlema for him. And anybody who would like to participate in that sponsorship should see Betsy Sanker to make that possible. Thank you all. Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, in his most recent book, which is Tales Out of Jerusalem, he has a section called Justice and Mercy, Judaism and Christianity. And in that chapter, some of you may have read the book, I'm just going to repeat it, he recounts an interesting story. He writes that he never interrupted a public speaker in anger, but this month he did so. Why is that? He had been invited to a special program in Jerusalem City Hall. He lives in Jerusalem. This book is about Jerusalem. And Jerusalem City Hall was making a presentation of thanks to a group of about 75 American Jewish philanthropists who had supported Jerusalem in many different ways. And the chairman of the evening was a native Jerusalemite, an Israeli fellow, who gave a history of Jerusalem throughout the ages, and then he made the following statement. The statement he made was that, quote, Judaism gave the world the concept of justice, then Christianity came along and gave the world the concept of compassion, such as love thy neighbor as thyself. These two concepts are the basis of the civilized world today. That's what this chairman of the evening said. And so Rabbi Emanuel writes, to hear this mindless cliche repeated to a Jewish audience, by a Jewish official in the city hall of the holy Jewish city, and to have him embellish it by suggesting that love thy neighbor, which specifically appears in the Torah, it's a pasuk in Vayikra in Leviticus chapter 19, that it's a Christian concept, that was way too much for him to bear. And he writes, and I'll just read his words because he's far more eloquent than I am, I felt the anger and resentment rise up within my chest, and I could no longer contain it. I rose to my feet and said very calmly, sir, with all due respect, I cannot allow that statement to go unchallenged. The idea that justice is exclusively Jewish and that love and compassion are exclusively Christian simply does not hold water. You have repeated a Christian claim about Judaism, but even a superficial look at the Torah will show that such thinking is simply untrue. One look at Leviticus 19 is enough to underscore the sheer fallacy of this, and I am frankly very distressed to hear such a discredited cliche from a Jewish speaker right here in the midst of the holiest city in the world. And the speaker reacted to it eventually after everyone got over their shock, because certainly anybody who knew Rabbi Emanuel knows that he's not somebody to interrupt the speaker in that manner. And even those who didn't, obviously they were surprised, and the person apologized and corrected his mistake. And he writes that I was unhappy about creating that small disturbance, but I could not permit the audience to go away with this information in their head. So tonight's topic is that specific value of that this chairman attributed to Christianity, which is the value of love thy neighbor as thyself, the idea of chesed, of caring and giving and connecting with other human beings. And we hope to correct this misconception, and we're going to show tonight that Judaism is full. It's replete with the theme of chesed pretty much in every parsha in the Torah, actually in every parsha in the Torah, and many parshas, and almost every pasuk, you see this theme of chesed coming up. And it's not only a component of our belief system, but chesed, in fact, is probably the overarching and defining feature of basically everything that we as Jews believe about what our mission in the world is. Now, chesed, of course, is not specifically Jewish, as the individual at that event said. It's really a universal value. Certainly today it is. Perhaps in ancient times it wasn't, but today it's a universal value. And in our society, especially for us who live in the South, being a nice person and doing acts of loving kindness is definitely something that people strive to do. And many non-Jews are very much plugged into this value. I believe it was Mark Twain who said that kindness is the language that the deaf can hear and that the blind can see. Something that transcends pretty much everything. And everybody is moved by loving acts of kindness. This is something that is across the board valued. But what's unique, I think, about Judaism, and we're going to talk about that tonight as well, in addition to the fact that chesed is a very major part of our belief system, of our theology, but what's very unique about about the Jewish approach is that halacha is not just, is that it's actually legislated in halacha, right? Halacha, when most of us think about halacha, we think about keeping Shabbos, we think about keeping kosher, we think about details of ritual, right? But the truth is that many aspects of chesed actually appear in halacha, and they're legislated the same way keeping kosher is, right? The way you visit a sick person, right? It's not just an abstract concept, go visit a sick person. No, we actually get down to the nitty-gritty of what it is. Why are we visiting a sick person? What's the benefit? Exactly how can you fulfill your obligation in doing so? And that's another thing that we're going to talk about. And this topic, probably more than any other topic in this Essentials program, is a topic that I think a lot of you here certainly have something important to contribute to. Just looking around the room, I know a lot of you are paragons of chesed in this community. Some of you are paragons of chesed even abroad. And I'm going to try to avoid just telling contemporary stories about kindness because I know so many of you have stories that you yourselves can share with us, and I certainly hope that you do so and make this lesson complete. So I'm going to be focusing more on the Torah approach to chesed, but certainly if anybody has any comments that they'd like to color and illustrate some of the ideas that we share, please feel free to do so. So let's start with source number one in the source sheets. First, we're going to talk about the centrality of chesed. And this, what we're going to try to do here is basically refute what that individual in Jerusalem said, and which is that at the center of Judaism is really justice and not so much chesed. And the truth is, chesed plays a very, very basic role in our understanding in what the Torah is. And of course, we try to live by the Torah. And so the first source is a passage that appears in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, in the Gemara, which was sealed roughly around the year 500. And Rabbi Simlai, in the Babylonian Talmud, in Tractate Sota, Mezechta Sota, 14a, he writes, and I'll read the Hebrew and then translate, he says, "Atorah tchilasa gemilas chasadim v'sofa gemilas chasadim," that the Torah begins with acts of loving kindness, with chesed, and it ends with acts of loving kindness and chesed. Tchilas gemilas chasadim, it begins with acts of loving kindness. How is that? Shenemar vayas Hashem Elokim la'adam u'lishto k'sones or ve'el b'shem, and sofa gemilas chasadim shenemar v'ekbor osobagai. Right, at the beginning we learned God's chesed for Adam and his wife was when he made clothing for them. Hashem makes clothing for Adam and his wife when they realize that they are naked, during that entire narrative with the Garden of Eden. And at the end, the Torah closes with Hashem burying Moshe. So we see that the Torah is bookended by this concept of chesed. And as we already mentioned, pretty much every part of the Torah, as you go through the story, you will find this theme of chesed. But certainly the beginning and the end. And the truth is that probably the most famous pasuk that refers to the act of loving kindness and caring about other people is the verse that was quoted by that individual, by Rabbi Emanuel Feldman in that story, and that is the verse of V'ahavta l'arecha kamocha. We will come back to this verse again, but that is the verse that says, "You shall love your fellow like yourself," and that is the source from Leviticus chapter 19. And there's the famous episode which is recorded in Tractate Shabbos. Shabbos on 31a, there's an incident where a Gentile comes to Shammai, the elder, and says, teach me the entire Torah while I'm standing on one foot. And Shammai basically tells him to go fly a kite, go have a nice day. This is not the way that we approach Judaism. This is serious business. And then he goes to Hillel, the elder, and Hillel then says, that which is hated to you, you shall not do to anybody else. This is the entire Torah, and the rest is commentary. These famous lines of Hillel echo throughout Jewish history, and this is really a bold statement of what being Jewish is all about. It's really about loving other people and not doing to them what you wouldn't want done to yourself. And then Rabbi Akiva, later on in history, Rabbi Akiva, after the destruction of the Second Temple period, he also famously said that this mitzvah of loving your neighbor like yourself is a klal gadol b'Torah. It's a great rule of the Torah. This is the great rule of being Jewish and keeping the Torah, is loving your neighbor like yourself. And in source 2, you'll see that even in the prophets, in the book of Micha, in Perek Vav, Pasuk Ches, 6-8, it says, "Higid l'cha adam atov," God has told you, man, what is good and what does he demand of you? Only to do justice, to love chesed, and to walk modestly with your God. If you want to encapsulate what Judaism really is, it is to do justice. Of course, justice is a Jewish trait. It's to love chesed, right? Loving chesed, and the third is to walk modestly with your God. So loving chesed is one of these very major parts of the DNA of our Jewish theology, of our Jewish belief system. And there's a verse in Tehillim and Psalms as well. It says, Olam Chesed Yibana, which your rabbis interpret as saying that the world was built, is built through Chesed. And that's that verse appears in Tehillim in chapter 89. Now let's move on to source number 3. So source number 3 is the Mishnah in Avos. This is probably the clearest statement of basically everything that I've been telling you. This is really corroborates and says it very pointedly. The Mishnah in Avos, again, what is Mishnah? Just to recap for some of you who are not so familiar, right? There was, when God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, there was the written Torah. We believe there was an oral Torah as well. And the oral Torah remained oral for many years until approximately the year 180 or 200, roughly 1800 years ago, when Rabbi Judah the Prince decided that he has to actually redact it or gather it together and write it down and edit it and actually put it into writing. So finally, the oral Torah also was put into writing, at least some version of it, and that is what is known as the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the first major body of oral law written down, and the Mishnah is divided into 6 orders. And one of those 6 orders is the order of Nezikin, of damages. It deals with torts, and it ends with the tractate Avos, Pirkei Avos. Now, Pirkei Avos is commonly referred to as Ethics of the Fathers. It is one of the tractates of the Mishnah. So the first, and again, the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos starts off listing the chain of the transmission of the oral law from the times of Moshe receiving the Torah on Har Sinai, and then it talks about how the oral law was transmitted through the generations. So it starts with Moshe received the Torah from God on Mount Sinai, who then transmitted it to Joshua, right? Joshua to the prophets to the judges, etc., going down through history. And then and the judges eventually gave it to the men of the Great Assembly. And if you want actually a name-by-name transmission that does appear in Maimonides' introduction to his code, it's very fascinating because there aren't too many steps really between the giving of the Torah and when it was actually redacted and written down. So it's a pretty fascinating thing that we have this, the integrity of the oral tradition was really preserved. So that's the first Mishnah. It pretty much tells us the transition. And then the second Mishnah, the very second Mishnah, is the teaching of Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. Okay, and this is going to be source number 3. Simon the Just, it doesn't say it in the source, but this is said by Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just, who was a high priest, who lived during the times of Alexander the Great. In fact, there's a famous passage in the Gemara that recounts how there was an encounter between Alexander the Great and Simon the Just, Shimon HaTzadik, who was the high priest, and Alexander was coming to destroy Jerusalem, and he went out and greeted him, and as a result, and Alexander got off his horse, bowed down, and said, "This is the man who is the key to all of my successes." And we can talk about that another time, but it's a very interesting story. But Shimon HaTzadik was the last of the men of the Great Assembly. He was the last survivor of the men of the Great Assembly. So the teaching that he is about to teach us in the second Mishnah in this gathering of ethics is going to be the teaching that Hu Haya Omer means this is what he used to walk around saying. This is the defining teaching of Shimon HaTzadik. And again, Shimon HaTzadik is the last of the men of the Great Assembly. And the men of the Great Assembly brought us some highlights of Judaism, such as the concept of the Amidah prayer, praying the Shemona Esrei every day. Right, the men of the Great Assembly, they canonized the Tanakh. Right, these are pretty serious, probably the most serious group of Jews ever to live. And Simon the Just is the last of these men, and he is about to tell us what he received, the transmission he received from them, passing it on. And what does he say? He says the following: Al Shlosha Devarim Ha'olam Omeid. The world stands on 3 things: Al Torah, it stands on Torah; Al Avoda, it stands on divine service, probably prayer or service in the temple. And the third is Gemilas Chasadim, acts of loving kindness. That's the teaching. The three pillars of the world, right? The three legs of the stool that is the world, of the chair that is the world, is, again, Torah study, service of God, and Chesed, loving kindness. And Rabbi Ari Levin, who was a rabbi who lived in Jerusalem in the early 1900s, was famous for his work with Jewish prisoners during the time when the Jewish underground was fighting the British. He, in his commentary on this tractate, he says that this is a very, very bold statement. From the first Mishnah in this tractate, you might think that Torah is the only value of Judaism, right? The Torah is the only value. What Shimon HaTzadik is writing in the second Mishnah, he is being very, very clear. Don't think that it's all about studying Torah. It's not. It's not. The world stands on 3 things, not just Torah. Torah is one of them. It's also service of God, and it's also acts of loving kindness. Don't ever think that acts of loving kindness is second rate, that it doesn't rank up there with a very basic Jewish obligation. And in fact, there's a passage in the Talmud that says that a person who has Torah but who doesn't engage in acts of loving kindness is living without a God. It's just not a fulfillment of what a Jew is supposed to, of how a Jew is supposed to live. The next source number four, is a commentary on that Mishnah, which is the Maharal of Prague, who was a great rabbi from the 1500s. And he comments on this. And so I'm going to summarize the first two paragraphs. He basically says, why these three things? Why does the world stand on these three things? And he says that everything that was created only deserves to exist in as much as it's inherently good. And then he says in the next paragraph that man's capacity for goodness can be divided into three parts. His own goodness is one part. Second is his goodness in relationship to God. And the third is his goodness in relationship to his fellow human beings. So the first is his goodness in relationship to God. I'm sorry, his own intrinsic goodness is Torah study. And his relationship to God is probably service. And the third is going to be his relationship to others, which is chesed. And he writes again in the last paragraph of source 4, chesed corresponds to this third aspect of man's life. It is eminently clear that when man performs kind deeds for his fellow man without expecting any reimbursement, he is being good towards them. There is in fact no greater good than when one bestows kindness upon others from his own volition. In doing so, he is truly and really good. So we're building the case here for chesed being very central to being Jewish, to living a Jewish life. There is also a passage in the Talmud that says that a Jew can be identified by three character traits. And in fact, this has halachic ramifications, as we'll see in Source 5. But it says that a Jew could be identified as a merciful person, as a baishan, a meek person, and a gomel chesed, a person who engages in loving kindness. And in fact, halachically, if you see somebody who claims to be Jewish who's missing any of these three character traits, Maimonides writes that you might want to look into whether or not they are actually Jewish, if they're lacking any of these things. So that's pretty serious stuff. And in fact, if you go to any Jewish community, including this one, you see, as a community, people engage in tremendous acts of loving kindness, whether it's interest-free loans, I know some of you are involved with, or whether it's other types of entities called what are known as gemachs. Gemach is an acronym for gemilos chasadim, acts of loving kindness. Certainly in larger Jewish communities, it's far more common to have gemachs, but I remember when I lived in Jerusalem, the extent of the diversity of these gemachs that will literally lend you anything from children's toys to musical instruments to medical equipment. I believe in Israel there's a Yad Sarah, which is started as a gemach, which is actually like now a UN-recognized nonprofit for what it's done for the people of Israel, where anybody could just borrow medical equipment. It's pretty fantastic. In fact, just yesterday I was looking up just to see a list of gemachs up in New York in Far Rockaway, and I thought it was very funny to see that in addition to all these gemachs, and there were hundreds, there's actually a gemach, where you call a gemach to find out the numbers for all the other gemachs. So it's really, it's pretty interesting. So it's really endless. I mean, you could, you know, and Jewish communities are blessed with having having chesed as a very, very central part of their fabric. And then source 5, again, is the quote from Maimonides about these three character traits. So these are major sources of the centrality of Judaism. And another source has to do with the holiday of Shavuos, which we celebrate right a bit after Pesach. In the holiday of Shavuos, we read the book of Ruth. And it's a bit interesting because what connection is there to read the book of Ruth on the holiday of Shavuos? The holiday of Shavuos, again, is the holiday that we commemorate the giving of the Torah, right? And it doesn't really seem to have any direct connection. So there are various explanations given. But one explanation given and from the times of the rabbis of the Mishnah is that the book of Ruth is full of acts of chesed, acts of loving kindness, and therefore it's to teach you that what defines Torah at the core of what Torah is doing acts of loving kindness, and don't make any mistakes about that. And this belief that chesed is so central is actually very, very empowering. I recall when I was teaching in Jerusalem at a yeshiva called Esha Torah, there was a legendary chef there. His name was Herschel Arno, a very interesting man. And he once told me that in this particular yeshiva, you have a lot of young men who come from the United States. Many of them come from a weaker Jewish background, so coming to study, a lot of their family members might not be so observant. And he once told me that very often parents of these students would come to the yeshiva and he would talk to them and they would say, you know, I'm not actually observant personally. And so what he used to tell them, he said he would open a siddur. And every morning, if you look at the siddur, right before the morning blessings, there's a Mishnah quoted from the tractate of Peah. And the Mishnah says, Elu devarim she'adam ochel parosem ba'olam hazeh. The following things are the major mitzvot that a person eats. The fruit of the mitzvot, the profit of doing that mitzvah in this world, but the principle is retained for the next world. And we're about to list mitzvot that are very significant. And so he starts going through them. And he says, the first one is, kibud avim, honoring your parents. So he turns to them, do you honor your parents? Yes, I do. Right? The next one, gemilus chasadim, acts of loving kindness. Do you ever do acts of loving kindness? Sure do, right? And then it goes through them, one by one. And the vast majority of them, people who call themselves not observant, are actually doing. Right? You also have their visiting the sick, attending funerals to escort a deceased person on his way. Right? You have rejoicing with a bride and a groom. Right? All these things are listed, and roughly I would say 80 to 90% of the mitzvahs listed in that Mishnah are things that are performed by people who claim not to be observant. So it's a very empowering message for people that the truth is that Judaism is not all about the ritual, and you could be a very observant person without necessarily doing the ritual. Of course, the ideal is to do everything, but a person shouldn't call themselves not observant if they're engaged in these acts of loving kindness, as most Jews are. So moving on, let's look at source number 6. Source number 6 is a verse that appears in Sefer Devarim, the fifth book of the five books of Moses, and this is interesting. The psukim there are talking about, the verses are talking about what type of Gentiles will have difficulty entering the Jewish community. Right? Typically, a person who's not Jewish who converts to Judaism, he's immediately welcomed as a Jew. We marry into their families, no problem at all. But says in Deuteronomy chapter 23, it says, an Ammonite and a Moabite should not enter the congregation of God to eternity because they did not greet you with bread and water on the road when you were living in Egypt and because they hired Bilam to curse the Jewish people. So it's very fascinating that a Ammonite and a Moabite, these two nations, who are these people, first of all, right? So we know there's the story of Sodom, right, that was destroyed, and Lot, who was Abraham's nephew, managed to escape. Abraham arranged for him to escape from Sodom. His wife turned around, became a pillar of salt, but him and his daughters survived. And long story short, his daughters thought they were the last remaining people living, had relations with their father, had two children. Those children were the forebears of these nations, Ammon and Moab. So they're family with us. They're mishpacha. We're related to them. Thank you. So we're related to them. And it's, what's interesting is that the verse says that these people can never, ever join the Jewish people. They have a lower status than random Gentiles that convert to Judaism. Why? And the reason is because when the Jewish people were traveling from Egypt up to the land of Israel, they did not greet the Jews with bread and with water. There's a second reason given, but the primary reason is bread and water. And this is in stark contrast with some of our worst enemies. Right? Let's think about the nations that have persecuted us the most, the Egyptians. These people enslaved us for 210 years. You would think there should be some penalty for them, right? Is there a penalty for them? Yes, there is. Three generations they have to wait to marry into the Jewish people. Three generations, right? But more than that, we don't wait. And the reason is that when Jacob first went down to Egypt, they were welcomed initially, right? Even worse, what about descendants of Esav, Amalek? How about Amalek? Amalek, we're actually, right, there's a commandment, Timcha Ezecher Amalek. Amalek is considered our worst enemy. The worst. It doesn't get worse than Amalek. And what's interesting is that Maimonides is pretty clear that an Amalekite comes to convert to Judaism, after several generations, an Amalekite can join the Jewish people. You would think that Egyptians and Amalekites will have a worse DNA than the Ammonites and the Moabites. So why is it the Ammonites and Moabites have to wait they can never join Jewish people, right? What is that? What is that? And so what we see is a very, very, very powerful message here, about the importance of doing acts of loving kindness, and I'm going to try to flesh that out in the next stage of what we're going to go through. So it's just an interesting contrast, and hold on to that question for now. So moving along, so why is chesed such a central principle of Judaism. Why is it? We just proved that it is. Okay, that's pretty much an established fact. I don't think anybody can argue with it. Chesed is up there and certainly in the top three values of Judaism. Why? What is it about that? So if we look at source number 7, a verse also from Deuteronomy, it says, "Acharei Hashem Elokechem telechu ubotid bakun," that you shall follow after the Lord your God and you shall cleave to God. You shall cleave to God. So what does that mean? So source number 8 is a quote from the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud in Sota. Very beautiful quote, I think. It says that Rabbi Chama, the son of Chanina, who was a rabbi from the times of the Talmud, he says, what is the meaning of following the Lord your God? Right? And it is actually, this is a partial quote. The Gemara says, how can you literally follow God? No, we all know God is everywhere. You can't actually follow God. It's impossible. So what does it mean? This teaches us to follow God's attributes. Just as God clothed the naked, as it is written, God made clothing for Adam and Eve, so to you shall. God visited the sick, as we see earlier in the book of Bereishis, a month or so back, that God appeared to Abraham, and he visited the sick. God comforted the mourners. As it is written, after the death of Abraham, God came and blessed Isaac. And therefore, you too shall comfort the mourners. God buries the dead, as we know, God buried Moses in the valley, and so too you shall bury the dead as well. So the way you can cleave to God and fulfill this biblical obligation of cleaving to God is by looking at God's behavior, whatever that means, right? God doesn't have behavior. Looking at what happens in the books of the Chumash and trying to emulate what you see, and specifically its acts of loving kindness. And so that's one major reason for why why doing chesed is so central. Second reason is that, let's go back to why did God create the world? I know this is not, there's a different essentials class probably dealing with that, I don't know if you've done it yet, but why did God create the world, right? If God is all-powerful and doesn't need anything, then why would he choose to create the world? What's the point? And so what we're taught is that the reason God made the world is so that he can give to us. It's all about giving to us. It's to give us reward, to create entities that he can give reward to, which is us. Now the only reason to give reward is if there's free will, and if there's free will, then you can obviously make the choice to do the wrong thing and you'll wind up getting punished. But the real purpose of creation, the real reason God created the world, is exclusively to give good to man. That is the Jewish belief. Exclusively to give good to man. Now let's go back to our question about the Ammonites and Moabites, why they can never join the Jewish people. All right? So, and this is a thought that I saw fleshed out very beautifully by Rabbi Nevensaal. Rabbi Avigdor Nevensaal is the chief rabbi of the old city of Jerusalem. A wonderful person. And the way he says it beautifully, he says that Egypt and Amalek, who are awful people who did horrible things to the Jewish people, right? It's true. They are missing spiritual limbs. They really are. These are people that are not spiritually whole. They are missing spiritual limbs. But they are all limbs that can be healed if it goes through the right kind of therapy. With the right kind of physical therapy, people, descendants of Amalek and Egypt, can possibly be repaired spiritually. But what Ammon and Moab, what they did, their relatives are traveling on the road and they're passing by. And they owe a debt of gratitude to these people because their ancestor Abraham saved their ancestors. The least they could do is bring out bread and water. Why wouldn't they do that? There must be something so corrupt about who they are that actually touches to the core of their being, right? And it's compared to a person who's missing a heart or missing a brain. A person who's missing a heart or missing a brain, no amount of physical therapy is going to help, right? And that's why a descendant of Ammon and Moab can never join the Jewish people, because they're missing something so basic and so fundamental.
Do these people exist today?
Great question. Do the Ammonites and Moabites exist? Fantastic question. So there's in the Talmudic times, which is 1700 years ago, there was a convert from Ammon who came into the study hall, and he wanted to know, can I join the Jewish people? And the rabbis who were in the study hall, they analyzed it. There was a debate. But what came out is that when slightly before the first temple was destroyed, there was a the man who basically did it was a man named Sennacherib or Sennacherib, and he had a very brilliant plan for how to colonize the world, how to take over different empires, different countries. And what he did is that he did what's called population transfers. Typically, the reason why a nation will revolt against an occupier is because they feel a strong connection to a piece of the soil, to the land. Right? So what Sennacherib did, something brilliant, is that when he took over a country, he took the entire population, shipped them out to another country. Right? They took the people of the second country and put them in the first country. All right? And therefore, as a result, post the dispersion the man-made dispersion of Sancheriv, nobody actually knows what nation they come from. So the short answer to your question, it is debated by rabbis of the Mishnaic time period, but the conclusion is that we don't have to be worried about somebody who happens to come from the geographic location of Ammon and Moab, all right, which is modern-day Jordan, or the capital of Jordan is Amman, which is Ammon, right, more or less. So somebody who comes from that part of the world, we don't have to be worried that they're Ammonites and Moabites nowadays. That's a great question, though. Okay, so moving along here. So that's the second reason for why Chesed is so fundamental, because God created the world to give, and these are people who don't appreciate the basic purpose of existence. Source number three. Reason number three, which is source number nine, is that Chesed, act of doing Chesed, causes us to look beyond our selfish ego and to be aware of goodness to others and to do to others and that others do to you. And this is beautifully written by the quote in number nine by Rabbi Yecheskel Levenstein. Who lived in the 20th century. He writes, a person that's preoccupied with taking anything he can for himself does not notice that others are bestowing kindness upon him. Right? When he's able to step out of himself and break away from the ego, so to speak, and become an outwardly focused and giving person, individual, he becomes aware of the kindness that he receives from others, since he now appreciates that others exist. This will specifically affect his relationship with God, for he will become aware that he is constantly and consistently showering him with kindness. It is therefore clear that developing an attitude of chesed brings someone closer to an awareness of God's existence. So when you go and assist somebody with something, when you're giving, you are developing in yourself a character trait of awareness of others, of awareness of people outside of your own, what we call the four cubits of yourself, right? You become aware of other human beings. And when you become aware of others and what you can do for others, you also become aware of what others do for you. And when you become aware of what others do for you, you become aware of what God does for you. And that causes you to live with a greater God consciousness, which is what the purpose of the world really is. So that's a third reason. Just as an illustration for this, there's a friend of mine back in Baltimore. He travels a lot. Some of you may know him. His name is Sam Seidemann. Fellow is roughly 60 years old, very interesting man, and he's probably the nicest person I've ever met in my life. And just as an illustration of how nice of a guy he is, he will only fly Southwest Airlines because they allow him to go around giving out the pretzels and peanuts and talking to people. That's like the type of person he is. I'm serious. And he just loves people. He really just loves human beings. And so this guy, Sam Seidemann, who in my mind, I mean, he is a giant of interpersonal relationships. So when this individual would come to your house, he's come to my house many times and partake of a meal at your house. So most people, if I go to your house and you serve me a salad and it's delicious, I'll say, that's a delicious salad, but not Sam Seidemann. What Sam will do is say, he would say the following. He'd say, this salad is fantastic. You have to go to the store and pick out those vegetables. Put them in your cart, check out, come home, right? Cut them up. Look at how you cut those vegetables. And you combine the perfect colors. And then you have this, you have the lettuce, you have the tomatoes, you have the peppers, and they all together form this amazing symphony. And the dressing, the way it's positioned on it, look at how beautiful this is, right? It's a very different way of showing gratitude, right? This is a man who lives with an awareness of every single step that goes into doing good things for other human beings, right? And in fact, some of you may, those of you who make it far enough into the Pesach Seder will realize that the famous paragraph in the Haggadah of Dayenu, Day Dayenu, the famous song, right? So what is that? It's pretty bizarre, because what happens is we say, God, had you taken us out of Egypt but not given us the Torah, that would have been enough, etc., etc. Now the truth is that would not have been enough. We would not be a Jewish people without the Torah, right? So that paragraph doesn't actually, it's actually not true, right? So what are we doing there? And so what we're doing there, one explanation is similar to what Sam Seidemann does with salad, is that instead of just saying, God, thank you for making us the people we are, we're actually breaking down each component of the salvation that we live with, the salvation that occurred that led to us becoming the people that we are. And so we're talking about, God, you took us out of Egypt, you gave us the Torah, you brought us into the land of Israel, etc., etc. Now, each one of those things would not have been sufficient to make us the people we are, but by acknowledging each step, we are becoming better people. And a fourth possible reason is, a reason several commentaries say, that man is created in the image of God, we know that, and that when I do chesed for you, that when I do acts of loving kindness for you, I'm acknowledging the fact that you are godly, that you are an elevated human being, and therefore when I do that, I'm also essentially saying to myself, I'm capable of greatness too. And so by doing chesed for others, you're acknowledging their greatness, which is essentially acknowledging your own greatness as a human being, and which is basically a very, it's an empowering message for yourself, and it's a challenge to yourself to live as an elevated person. Now, what constitutes chesed? We've been talking about this concept a lot. What constitutes chesed? What is it? So, the source number 10 is a quote from the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim is called the Chafetz Chaim after a book that he wrote, which is a book about the laws of Lashon Hara, of gossip. His real name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. And he wrote another book called Ahavat Chesed, Love of Kindness. And it's an entirely separate book. And in that book, he says that Gemilas Chasadim, bestowing kindness, refers to any type of voluntary good that one does for another. Sometimes it might involve loaning money. Other times it constitutes actually involving yourself in helping others, such as exerting yourself on behalf of guests, etc. So what's clear is that there is no one definition of what loving kindness is. It's a very flexible type of thing, and you have to adapt to the circumstances and the needs of those around you. And in Source 11, I'll just say quickly, Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, who also only passed away 5 or 6 years ago, he says that acts of loving kindness can include giving people words of encouragement to bring them joy. And we'll talk about that a little bit more a bit later too. Right? There are so many acts of chesed that are easily within our reach. It's basically anything that a person does for others. Now this is all true, but there are some classical examples. There are some classic examples of what acts of loving kindness are. And as we said, there was the list of loving kindness that we said to emulate God, you should do that list of visiting the sick, etc. There's that also that the mitzvahs that a person gets rewarded in this world and next world, like that chef used to tell parents. So let's talk about some of those. And yes.
What chesed, is it what I feel like doing, or is it what the person needs?
I think it's very much what the person needs. Now, there's something else called doing chesed for yourself, which is also important. And if you feel you need to do certain things, then you know certainly you should do them. But primarily, it's about being aware of other people's needs, and we'll see some sources about doing chesed for yourself as well. So Maimonides, the Rambam, in his classic code, the Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, lived 1135 to 1204 in Spain and land of Israel and Egypt. And in his classic code, he divides all of Jewish law into 14 sections. He writes that there is a specific rabbinic mitzvah to visit the sick. This is source 12. Comfort mourners, bury the dead, marry off a bride, escort visitors, gladden the bride and the groom, as well as look after their needs. These are all called gemilas chasadim. And they're also, those are rabbinic, but in addition, you're fulfilling the biblical commandment of loving your fellow like yourself, as yourself. Whatever you would want done for yourself, you shall do for others. So let's talk about visiting the sick a little bit. As I mentioned before, these laws of acts of loving kindness are legislated the same way that other laws are, and we're going to illustrate that. Okay, so let's talk about visiting the sick, the mitzvah of visiting the sick. Now, it's not just an abstract, nice idea. Right, as we already referenced in earlier in Sefer Bereishis in the book of Genesis, it says that God came to visit Abraham himself. Why was Abraham sick? Because he had just had the first bris milah in history. He was circumcised, right? And God came to visit him. Now, visiting the sick is a very, very important, very central act of loving kindness. There's a story that appears in the Talmud in Nedarim 40a, in the Mem Amud Aleph, that talks about Rabbi Akiva, great Rabbi Akiva, from the second century of the Common Era. He had a student who was ill, and none of his colleagues came to visit him until Rabbi Akiva, his rabbi, went to visit him, and he cleaned the room for him, and he arranged for food and medicine to be brought, and this person said that had you not come, I would have died. And Rabbi Akiva went out from that incident and he taught that one who does not visit the sick is as if he has committed an act of murder. This is a powerful statement, a very bold statement to make. So the question is this. One of the more contemporary questions in halacha is, can you fulfill the mitzvah of visiting the sick by calling somebody on the phone? Right? If you call somebody who's ill on the phone, did you fulfill your obligation to visit the sick person? So this is a question that's addressed by contemporary halachic, by poskim, Rabbi Avadi Yosef, passed away last year, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who died in 1987. So he said, so they both addressed this question. So let's first talk about why is it a mitzvah to visit the sick? What practical benefit do you give a person who is ill by visiting? So one simple explanation would be that you can see the person and you can make sure that the room is clean, that the room that he's in is clean, and that they have the food and the medication that they need. And in fact, the rabbis from the medieval time, probably way ahead of their time, made it very clear that having a sick person in a clean room contributes to their physical health. Right? Being in a hygienically clean facility is actually beneficial to a person's health. But let's say a person is in, let's say somebody who's ill, he's in a state of the art hospital. Everything is clean. The doctors are attentive. The nurses are attentive. What does the person gain when you come visit them? So another benefit of visiting the sick is that a visit provides emotional support to a person. And as we all know, a person's emotion is very much connected to their physiological progress. And the way, when you encourage a person, you cheer them up, you can definitely accelerate their healing process. So that's a second reason brought in halacha too. A third reason, a very central reason, which very many people are not so familiar with, is that visiting the sick is an imperative because when you visit a sick person and you see the person in the state that they're in, then the image of their condition is much more vivid to you. And then you have an obligation to go and pray on that person's behalf. And the prayer that you then offer is a much more powerful prayer than had you just heard about the person's condition. So by literally seeing him, it contributes to the power of prayer. And this is such a central reason for visiting the sick that Nachmanides, also a medieval halakhic authority, he says clearly, if you visit a sick person and do not pray for them, you did not fulfill the mitzvah of visiting the sick. Right? That is very central to the mitzvah of visiting a sick person. And of course, when we do pray for a sick person, the terms that we use are always plural, right? That this person should be healed amongst all the other ill members of the Jewish people, because we know that there's a power of in numbers of being connected with the Jewish people, and that can contribute to their healing as well. Yeah. Yeah, the ideal would be to do so. In fact, the Talmud says that when a person is ill, the divine presence is hovering at the head of the bed. That has halakhic ramifications that we're not going to get into, but what's clear from the sources that literally by the ill person's bed is actually a location that is more conducive for prayer. But I believe you do fulfill your obligation if you do if you offer a prayer when you leave the person's room. But ideally, if you can pray there, that would be optimal, I believe. Yeah, that would have fallen probably into just a general category of acts of loving kindness. So whatever you can offer that person, and I don't know about if somebody's elderly but not ill. So I don't think the divine presence is necessarily in the room as it's defined in halakha. But to be able to see him and to provide for his needs and certainly to encourage him, as you said, you probably are much better served going to him in person. Now, I don't know if any contemporary authorities discuss the advent of Skype or other video situations. They would alleviate some of these issues, but probably not all of them. And certainly, the optimal way to fulfill the mitzvah of visiting the sick, if you can, is to go and actually visit the sick person. Right, so that sounds like Skype definitely contributes a lot, and this is not an advertisement for Skype. Any other? There are plenty of other options, but yeah, I mean, there's no question. Some of these major reasons for visiting the sick are definitely alleviated by a Skype visit. That's for sure true. Let's move on to the next major classic example of Gemilas Chasadim, and that's going to be the welcoming guests. Now, the rabbis talk a lot about the mitzvah of welcoming the guests. There's no greater mitzvah in the Torah. They say that a person who welcomes guests has a place in the garden in Gan Eden, in the world to come. It's clearly something that's very much extolled. And the major source for welcoming guests is the passage, which is quote number 13, source number 13, which is a continuation of the story of God visiting Abraham. So God is talking to Abraham. And it says here that Abram lifts his eyes, and behold, there were three men standing before him. And you have to remember, he's talking to God. And he saw them and ran to greet them from the entrance to his tent, leaving God behind. right? And bowed to them, and he said, if I found favor in your eyes, please don't pass over your servant. Let a bit of water be taken and wash your feet. Lean under the tree. I'll give you bread. You'll satiate yourself. And they said, we'll come. And then in the second paragraph, Abraham hastens to the tent, his wife Sarah, and says, quickly take 3 measures of fine flour, knead them, make cakes. Abraham ran to the cattle, took a calf, gave it to the lad, prepared it, gave them butter and milk, placed it before them, stood before them under the tree, and they ate. So there are a lot of lessons about welcoming guests into your home that are learned from these verses. First of all, Abraham, where did he live? We know that Abraham always positioned his tent at an intersection. He was trying to be in a location that was the best location for him to encounter as many guests as possible. So that's one value worth noting. But also we know, what's the story behind this? Abraham is the third day after the circumcision, the most painful day. And even though he's talking to God on this third day, he leaves God behind and goes out to do the mitzvah of welcoming guests. We see that welcoming guests, rabbis note, is greater than greeting the divine presence. Right? Whatever that means. I mean, that's a difficult thing to understand. And what does he do? He runs over to these three individuals, which we know from the sources were basically nomads. They were Bedouin Arabs. And he calls them masters. He refers to these simple people as masters. There was no indication that these were learned men or noble men of any kind. On the contrary. And he refers to them as masters. So you see there, right, to greet people and give them some respect. And he anticipated their needs, says, come in, sit under the tree. And another thing we see here is that he told them, I'll give you some bread. And what did he actually give them? You see in the second paragraph. He didn't just give them bread. He gave them meat. He gave them cakes. He gave them butter. Right? And we learn from there the Jewish value of say a little and do a lot. Sorry? All right, he calls him master again. That's true. Also, he includes the entire family in this mitzvah. So see, Abraham runs into the tent and asks his wife Sarah to start baking the cakes. And then it says he gave the calf to the lad, right? The lad we're taught is Yishmael, his son. And so he involved the entire family in this mitzvah. So we also see the value of including your whole family in this in participating in this. And then finally, he escorts them from his home, which we see the final mitzvah. The mitzvah is to escort an individual from your home. If you have a guest, we are taught that you should walk roughly 7 feet, 4 cubits out of your door to walk them along your way. Now, before we get into why that is, one interesting source I saw is that in Talmudic times, there was a custom in Jerusalem. Now, the men of Jerusalem were known to people who were very, very refined. There was a custom in Jerusalem that when a home was available for a guest, a random guest, to come in and partake of food, they used to hang a white kerchief on the door. And anybody who was walking down the street and was hungry would be able to knock on that door and, without being embarrassed, go in and be provided with food. And when a home was not, it wasn't a good time to host somebody, they would remove that kerchief. And that way, nobody was embarrassed to ask for food. And everything was known in advance. So it's a beautiful idea. How in modern times we can apply it is unclear. But the idea of not embarrassing people who would be hungry and basically marking your home as a place of hospitality is a beautiful thing. So what's up with escorting people from your house? So what's going on with that? So source number, I think when it comes to these numbers, things get a little bit fishy on the source sheets. Is that true? The next source is the Maharal. Escorting guests give honor to the divine image. So that way he writes, what's the reason? He says, when somebody sets out on his way and others see him off, they in effect give honor to the divine image in which he was created. If people fail to do so, it is as if they have shed his blood, for when one is robbed of the honor due to his divine image, this is true bloodshed. So by escorting somebody, you are saluting, you're showing respect to the divine that is in that person. And another way to understand it is that you are making a physical gesture that shows that you're tying your destiny with this person's destiny. Whether it means physically that in your town people know that this is somebody that is under your auspices somehow, or spiritually that your spiritual energy is connected to this person. Either way, what you are doing is you're providing that person with something that they can take with them, that they're not going alone, that you're actually escorting them on their way. There's an apocryphal story, I don't know if it's true, it's a very interesting thing, about this mitzvah of escorting people from your home. Well, we know that the facility that Abraham built to welcome guests. In the Torah, it's called an eshel. It's called an eshel. So now, what's an eshel? So two explanations, but one explanation is that it's basically an inn, a hotel to welcome people. But the rabbis teach that eshel is actually an acronym for three Hebrew words. The first Hebrew word, the first Hebrew letter of the word eshel is aleph, and that's where it stands for the Hebrew word achila, food, eating, providing food for somebody. The second one, shin, stands for shtia, drink, providing drink for a person. And the lamed in eshel stands for levaya, escorting a person from your home. These are the three major things that you provide for a guest. And there's a story, a very interesting story, about a particular town in Europe where somebody was very, very passionate about the mitzvah of welcoming guests and taking care of guests and providing them with wonderful food and drink and facilities. And he was a wealthy man, but unfortunately, the home that he used to provide this hospitality burnt down one time. So he goes to the local rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, why is it that my house burned down? Here it is. This is a house that I use only for the mitzvahs of welcoming guests." So the rabbi told him something very interesting. He said, "Remember, what Abraham had was called an eshel, which means there are three components: food, drink, and escorting. I know you provide food, I know you provide drink, but do you escort people out of your home?" And the man says, "The truth is, I don't. I don't escort people out of my home. That's something that I haven't done." So he says, the rabbi says to him, "Let's think about that. Eshel, when you take out the last letter, it's Aleph, Shin, and Lamed, all you're left with is Esh, fire." Right? And so that's why he says that perhaps is the reason why this house suffered this fate. I don't know if it's a true story. Either way, there's a value in escorting a person from your home, no question about it. Nobody needs to get nervous if they haven't been doing it until now, but you should certainly start doing it now if you can. One story about welcoming guests, which is a very, very personal story. I'm not sure, what time does this end? Does it end now? Okay, if anybody feels the need to leave, certainly feel free to do so. But one very personal story that I'd like to share about this, about welcoming guests is my grandfather, my mother's father. He's still alive. He lives in Jerusalem. Recently, not too long ago, made Aliyah from Minnesota, where he grew up. Actually was born, and his earlier years lived in Germany, in a small town outside of Cologne, Germany, Hachenberg, Germany. And in the late 1930s, things were getting very, very rough for his family. He himself experienced anti-Semitism. He was roughly 9 or 10 years old. Things were getting very, very ugly. And his family desperately was trying to get out of Germany to come to the United States. But the way things worked is that in order to be allowed into the United States, you needed to have a sponsor. You needed to have an American citizen who produced some kind of legal affidavit saying that I take responsibility for this person and they won't be a burden on society. So the problem was that my great-grandparents didn't know a soul in the United States. They desperately tried to get out, and they couldn't. And so one weekend, my grandfather, who at the time was 9 or 10 years old, I believe, he went to the neighboring village to visit his grandparents. My grandfather's name is Bert, so things are a bit confusing here. So young Bert went to visit his grandparents, and he was rummaging around in their attic, and he found in their attic a colorful postcard. And so he goes down to his grandfather, and he asks his grandfather what this postcard is. And there was a language written on it he didn't understand. His grandfather said, "Put the postcard back, don't worry about it." And they were a very proper German Jewish family. He said he always listened to what his grandfather said. He does not know why. He took the postcard, put it in his pocket, went home, back to his hometown. And he takes it out, and he shows it to his father. And he says, "Can you tell me what it says on this?" And his father looked at it. And his father realized what it was. What happened was that after World War I, and of course many German Jews fought in the German side of World War I. My great-grandfather was a lieutenant in the German army, decorated soldiers, many of them were. And after World War I, the Americans occupied Germany along with other Allied forces, and American soldiers were stationed in German towns. That's where they were quartered, in German towns. And there was an American Jewish soldier named Alex Lurie, from the city of Duluth, Minnesota, who was an American soldier looking for a Jewish home to take him in, because, of course, he can force himself into a random home, but he was looking for a Jewish home of the enemy, an enemy Jewish home, to welcome him in and take care of him. And he found my grandfather's grandparents, my great-great-grandparents, who took him in, and even though he was the enemy, they had been fighting each other, took very good care of him, were very gracious to him, they were very nice to him, and when he went back, after, I think, roughly 6 months, he went back to home to Duluth, Minnesota, which is a fairly decent-sized town. I think it's shrunk. He wrote a postcard, a thank-you note, to my great-great-grandparents, saying, thank you so much for how you treated me. I really appreciate having gotten to know you. And of course, this is in the probably close to 1920, I don't know, I would say. And so we're talking almost 20 years later, my grandfather finds this postcard. Now the catch is that the name was there, Alex Lurie. It didn't say the man's address. All it said was the city. And so my great-grandfather decided to take a risk. He wrote a letter, and he wrote to Alex Lurie, Duluth, Minnesota, without a street address. And he told them about their predicament, said, we need to get out. We have no other choice. We haven't spoken to you in 20 years, but we're hoping you can help us out. And Alex Lurie was apparently well-known in Duluth. And the postman saw it, and instead of throwing it out, which is what happens to a letter without an address on it, he actually brought it to him personally, and Alex Lurie got the letter, and he was the one who sponsored my grandfather's immediate family out of Germany, and they got out in 1938 or 1939, I forget which. Many of their relatives were wiped out, and they survived, and there are hundreds of descendants of this family throughout the world today. And I mean, it's a powerful story, but you see the power of hospitality here. What it did for my family. I mean, another thing is that in my family, everyone's very on top of writing thank you notes because, you know, that could be rough. But, you know, a thank you note really saved the lives of my grandfather, his two siblings, his parents, and the hundreds of their descendants. So that's a story about taking care of guests. Another classic case of chesed is clothing the naked. There are stories in the Gemara about there was a Roman ship that capsized, and this Roman nobleman shows up on shore holding onto a log or a piece of wood, whatever it is, and he shows up on shore, and he doesn't have any clothing on. He's completely naked. He's in the sand dunes, and he's calling out to the Jews, please give me clothes. And the Jews, having been persecuted by the Romans, right, most of the passerby says, I hope all Romans wind up in your condition. And they refuse to help him, right? Because they had been persecuted horribly. And one great rabbi from that time, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, he hears this man, he comes, he gives him his clothing, he provides him with a stipend, he takes care of him, escorts him, and says he's a human being, got to take care of him. And long story short, this man, many years later, was elected Caesar, or at least a local governor by the Roman Senate, and he tried to persecute the Jews horribly, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua was in position to help the Jewish people. So, you see where good deeds can take a person. Another source I have here is about burying the dead. This is what's called Chesed Shel Emes. The real source for that is actually this past week's Torah portion, Vayechi. It says that Jacob told Yosef, please do for me Chesed and Emes, and make sure I'm not buried in Egypt. And we're taught that the ultimate kindness is kindness done with a person who is no longer living. And the reason for that is that a person who's no longer living can never repay you for what you do for him. And that is why there's a rabbinic commandment. In the source it says, also a quote from Maimonides, to carry a coffin, to walk in front of it, to eulogize him, to dig the grave, and to actually bury him. These are examples of gemilas that are performed with one's body, and certainly members of the Chevra Kadisha, I'm sure some of you are here, are people who are doing this true kindness. I'm going to try to move a little quicker to cover ground here, but other non-classic examples of loving kindness are, one of them is referred to in the sources, simply smiling at people. Shammai says, right, Shammai, who most people would assume was a very stern person because he's always stricter than Hillel in the times of the Mishnah, Shammai says that you should greet every human being with a smiling countenance. He's the person who said it. This is the saying that he used to share with people. So you see, greeting people with a smile is very important. And in fact, in this past week's Torah portion, there's a blessing, there's the prophecy, really, by Judah, and it says that, what Jacob says to Judah, that part of the quote is that you shall be white-toothed from milk, and the rabbis understand from there that giving a person a smile is actually greater than providing a person with milk. It's actually greater than giving them something physical. Just giving them a smile and giving them the encouragement can actually be greater than that. And of course, greeting people, right? People think that this is a uniquely Southern thing, that greeting people whenever you have the chance. But also in the ethics of our fathers, there are several different places where it says that you should be the first to greet anybody. In fact, we're told Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was the great savior of the Jewish people during the destruction of the Second Temple. He said that nobody ever greeted him before he greeted them, ever, including Gentiles in the market. Nobody ever greeted him first. He always greeted other people first. In fact, there's a reference to this there's a commentary on the Chumash called the Baal HaTurim, who's very into numerology and gematria, and he says there's something very shocking in numerology, is that the word for peace in Hebrew, shalom, which is also how we greet people, is the same numerical value as the name Esav. Right? Esav is the arch opposite of Jacob. So what's going on with that? And so he understands that as saying is that when it comes to greeting people, saying shalom to people, don't think that Gentiles should not be included in that. And you should certainly greet people even if they're different. And there are stories, many, many stories of people who greeted others. There are stories from the Holocaust, from more contemporary stories, who greeted others and that really and showed them respect, and that really was helpful for them longer term. And giving charity, of course, is also a very important value of that's related to Chesed. And one thing that Maimonides makes it very clear that it's forbidden to embarrass a needy person. It's really, you can't do it. You need to, ideally, you should even give the charity privately. There's a passage, there's a story in the Gemara about Mar Ukva, who was a rabbi from the times of the Gemara, that him and his wife used to give charity to an individual without that person knowing. And one day that person said, I really want to know who my benefactor is, who this person is. And so Mar Ukva, that day he went with his wife to deliver the money or that they used to bring. And what happened was is that they saw this person waiting for them, and they put the money down, and before he could see who they were, they fled. And he chased after them, and the only place they could run to hide was in a hot furnace. That's the only option. It probably wasn't actually flames, but it was certainly hot. And so they went into this furnace, and this rabbi Mar Ukva's feet were being singed. So Mar Ukva's wife said, "Put your feet on my feet, and you'll be all right." And so he did, and everything was fine. So he says to his wife, "What's going on? Why aren't your feet burning and mine are?" She said, "The reason is that you give actual money as charity, but when a poor person comes to my house, I actually give them food." And so I remove a step in the charity process. Instead of giving them money to buy food, I actually give them the food. And so I have an additional merit for that reason. And so that's why my legs were not singed. So that's another, I would say, sensitivity when it comes to giving charity, another sensitivity. And in fact, Ezra the scribe, who basically recreated Judaism as we know it, one of the enactments he made during the beginning of this, during the Second Temple period, is that women should wake early in the morning, probably not only women, but a home should wake up early in the morning and bake bread so that if anybody were to come to your door hungry, you can have bread for them. And nowadays, thank God, we don't live in a society where people are knocking on doors hungry, but it's just also an additional level of sensitivity. Another source here is praying for the needs of others, such as praying for people to recover from illnesses, etc. And as we brought up, chesed with yourself. So there's an interesting passage in the Medrash, and this is source number 17. It says, "A man of chesed is good to himself." This refers to the likes of Hillel. Once, when Hillel was departing from his disciples, they asked him where he was headed. And Hillel said, "I'm on my way to perform chesed with a guest in my home." The students asked, "You always have a guest in your home? It seems like every day he was going home." And so he said, "Is the soul not a guest in the body?" So to an extent, or he says, after all, it is only here temporary. So to an extent, taking care of yourself is also a level of chesed. People shouldn't think that it's selfish to take care of yourself. Certainly, spiritually, to take care of yourself, it's actually a level of chesed. And then the final point, which is a very, very important point, is that chesed does not always involve giving. And I'm sure many of you already know this, that very often you can be a giver by being a taker. Right? That's also possible too. And in fact, we find that when it comes to serving God, we're told that you could serve God by eating a delicious food and you could serve God by sleeping. Right? Why? When before you go to sleep, you could say, "I'm going to sleep so that I should have strength to serve God tomorrow." Right? "I'm eating this food so I should have strength to serve God," whatever it is. So really, you can imbue these seemingly mundane acts with very spiritual reasons. And so similarly, we have by when you take something from somebody, it's possible to take something and do it for spiritual reasons. And Rabbi Shalom Shwadron, who is a rabbi in Jerusalem, also in the last century, he had a beautiful parable for this. He says, you can have two store owners, both of whom sell the exact same products at the exact same prices, but one of whom is a giver and one of whom is a taker. And how is that possible? And both of them, by the way, have good customer service. So how is that possible? They could be totally different. Because one has a desire to give to people, He really just loves giving stuff, giving things to people. He loves providing for them. However, if he would just give a product to people without receiving any money in return, he himself won't be able to survive and he can't continue giving. He therefore needs to take money for what he's doing in order to give. He needs to take in order to give. And you have somebody else who really just wants to take people's money. Problem is, people are not just going to give him money for no reason. So he has to provide them with a service. Right? And so he provides them with a service and then he gets their money. So they're both doing the exact same thing, but the attitudes that they have make what they're doing complete opposites. One is a giver, one is a taker. It's really about the end game. And really that really chesed comes down to really caring about others and feeling their pain. And it goes back to the verses of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, love your fellow like yourself. And there's also a source that I have, is a specific rabbinic mitzvah. I'm sorry for going over time. We're ending up here. To V'ahavta l'recha kamocha is actually connected to visiting the sick, etc., and all these other mitzvahs that we've quoted. And the Rambam Maimonides says that it's incumbent upon every person to love each and every Jew as himself, as it is written, you shall love your fellow as yourself. And in some sitters, there's actually written the Arizal, the great Kabbalist, actually has in his sitter, he says that before a person, the first thing a person should do in the morning, probably after Modani, before he prays, is that he should accept upon himself this mitzvah of loving every Jew like himself, and really work on that. That should be part of the service. And we, of course, we find that our ancestors, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they go out of their way to show love for others. Abraham prays for Sodom, wicked people, etc., and many, many sources. So Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook, who was the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, obviously before Israel's came into existence. He has a very, very powerful statement that he used to make. And this is a man who is famous for loving all Jews. That was Rav Cook, right? He's known to love all Jews. And he used to say the following. And he was very often engaged in petitioning the British government on behalf of Jews, whatever else it was. He used to say, I don't speak because I have the power to speak. I speak because I don't have the power to remain silent. That's what he used to say. Because as a Jew, my instinct doesn't allow me to be quiet when other Jews are in need and other Jews need assistance. And in this week's Torah portion, this is beautifully illustrated. We're taught in the Medrash, we know that Pharaoh decided to kill the Jewish males, right? And we're taught in the Talmud that Pharaoh had three primary advisors, okay? And you'll recognize all these names from other parts of Tanakh. From other parts of the Torah. Bilam was one advisor, famous Bilam who was sent to curse the Jews. Yisro, Jethro, who later became Moshe's father-in-law, second advisor. And the third was Eof, Job. Right? These three people were advisors to Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh approached him and said, should I go ahead and carry out this plan of killing all Jewish males? And so we're taught that Bilam said, go ahead and kill them. And Yisro said, And Yisro, instead of answering the question, he fled. He ran away from Pharaoh's palace, gave up his position in the royal palace. And Eov, he was silent. Eov was silent. He would just remain silent. Why was he silent? He said, what's the point? Why should I advise him differently? Pharaoh already has his mind made up. Why should I lose my position? I'll just be quiet. Maybe I can influence from the inside or whatever else. He justified it. And the Talmud is talking about how behavior is often punished in a way that matches the behavior that was performed. So Bilam, who said, kill the Jews, later on in the book of Joshua, he actually gets killed in battle with the Jews. Yisro, Jethro, who ran away from the royal palace, gave up royalty, his descendants were merited to sit on the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court of the Jewish people, which sat in God's palace in the Holy Temple. And Eov, who was silent, what was his punishment? We know the entire book of Eov is about a man who is afflicted with horrible, horrible pains, physical pains, family distress, etc. So the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he asks a great question. He says, I understand how these things make sense, that they correspond to each other. Bilam said kill, he was killed. Yisro fled, royalty, his descendants sat in royalty. What about Eo, being silent? How is a person who is silent in the face of genocide, why does that person deserve to receive a punishment that is physical pains inflicted on him? So what's the connection? And so he answers that when a person is truly feeling pain, They cry out regardless of whether or not their cries make a difference. Right? As we know, a person stubs his toe, right? He'll hopefully just say, ouch, right? And that is an expression of the pain he's in. It doesn't make it feel any better, right? Objectively. But that's just what a person does. It's instinct, right? And similarly, had Eov really felt the pain of what was going on, he would have cried out even though it wouldn't have made a difference. When a person instinctively feels pain, right, these political considerations are irrelevant, right? And this is the reason why you have some people who it might appear like they're engaged in an exercise in futility when they're protesting a particular cause. Very often you have Jews being persecuted. Many of you were probably involved with the Soviet Jewry, and I'm sure plenty of people said, "What's the point of protesting? What is the purpose?" And what we see from here, from this teaching of the Brisker Rav, is that sometimes protest might not actually change anything, but it's an expression of a person's inner self, and it's a reminder that you're actually a human, a feeling person who is connected with others. And just to end off, source 18 is Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler, who writes that a person should use his imagination to picture a person's suffering or lack there, or what he's lacking, similar to what we said about visiting a sick person to physically be present. And by visualizing it to whatever extent you can, it'll obviously help. And so, in conclusion, what we basically said is that everything in life is either taking or giving, right? Because even when you're taking, you could really be giving. That's the truth. And with the right perspective, you can be giving even when you're taking, right? And not only by giving, not only are we making the world a better place, but we're actually elevating ourselves and bringing ourselves closer to God. And there's a quote to end off with a non-Jewish quote, but Ralph Waldo Emerson, I think, has a beautiful quote. He says that you cannot do a kindness too soon because you never know how soon it will be too late. So hopefully, this will be an affirmation of what I'm sure everybody here knows, that chesed is very central to being Jewish, very central to being a human being, but specifically Judaism has chesed at the heart and soul of who we are. Thank you very much.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.